Hopkins. Bryant for the win.
Interviews from your favorite local coaches and athletes.
He's getting to the basket of will, and he's hitting that three-point shot with some consistency now, and he's just in a groove right now where he's pretty well unstoppable.
Hall of Fame and legendary guests.
I was driven by loving to play, liking the challenge of being an NFL quarterback, but after 18 years, I was 1 month short of 39 years old. It's time to go.
Analysis and insight on the latest national sports topics.
Sean Payton was horrible in clock management. That should never be the case with this New Orleans Saints team.
Well, we're waiting.
Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM.
Welcome into a brand new edition of Drive Time Sports. I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini. Always happy to be along with you on the afternoon drive. Very fun, very packed show coming up here today. Right now, we have high school baseball. It's already off and rolling. Carbon on the road taking on Provo. Emory at the moment at home in a home contest against North St. Pete. Tomorrow, Emory's going to take on Payson. Earlier today, I caught up with manager Rob Smith of the Emory Spartans. I wanted to get him on as quickly as we could because Emory had a very busy weekend, and now they'll play three games in 3 days. So we're going to replay that interview for you next segment. That'll be on the local sports front. We'll talk to Coach Rob Smith. Then we'll transition to the national scene, and I'm really excited for a guest that we have booked for the show today, Danny Tarkanian. He is the son of Hall of Fame and legendary college basketball coach Jerry Tarkanian. Right around the corner, it's March Madness, the NCAA tournament. A lot of exciting times if you're a fan of the game of basketball. I think you're going to love this interview. New book, it's out right now, it's called Rebel with a Cause. It's the true story of Jerry Tarkanian. Who better to tell that story than his son, Danny? So we'll get to that a little bit later on in the show. Danny is booked to join us for at least one segment on the show. I'm looking forward to that. Let's move over to the national sports headlines. And this was some news that broke earlier today. The Ivy League has canceled its conference basketball tournaments because of the coronavirus. The Ivy League said today that they had concerns about the spread of the coronavirus. It's a four-team tournament. It was scheduled to be played Friday through Sunday in Cambridge. Now, instead of playing the four-team tournament, the Ivy League is going to award its automatic NCAA tournament bid to the regular season champions. So that's Princeton on the women's side, and that's Yale on the men's side. The tournaments are the first at the Division I level to be canceled because of the coronavirus outbreak. This is something that we hear more and more about. And we talked to Bill Lasky about this yesterday as far as how Major League Baseball is trying to handle this. And he said they believe by April 1st, things are going to be taken care of. They believe once warm weather comes in that this thing's going to take care of itself. And so we haven't seen anything from Major League Baseball, but we are expecting a statement from them as soon as tomorrow. I believe we could actually get the statement. Now, there has been talk in the NBA about changing things up, barring fans, over the coronavirus. LeBron James said that he would be disappointed if the NBA was to play games without fans, but he's going to listen to whatever the league decides they believe is the safest thing. It's a quick turnaround because over the weekend, LeBron was asked about this, and he said he just wasn't going to play. He said it's that simple. He's not going to play if there are no fans at NBA games. I do know that the league has already given its recommendation to players as far as grabbing autograph items, like grabbing jerseys and balls and markers and pens. The league has already advised them not to do that. It really is starting to get serious, and we may see a lot of things altered as we get down to the home stretch of the NBA and the college basketball season. It's unlike anything that we've ever seen. There's no question about that. It's unlike anything that we've ever seen in this realm. Let's take a look at the news coming out of the NFL. The Cleveland Browns made a move today. They have released Christian Kirksey after six seasons. Kirksey, really one of the emotional and veteran leaders on this team, released him after the sides could not come to an agreement. He was supposed to make $7.7 million in a base salary this season, $8.2 million in 2021. The Browns are going to save about $6.5 million in cap savings this season by releasing him. He wrote a letter today saying he was forever grateful for the Browns. I know he's been hurt. I know the injured reserve list has kind of been his mainstay. But if this guy, who's a five-year starter, going into last season, he was a five-year starter, didn't get to play a whole lot. If this guy is relatively healthy, he's one of the bargains out on the free agent market, I could see him signing with a contender and signing for relatively cheap. That's really the only news coming out of the national sports scene or the NFL today that involves player movement or team news outside of that. Let's take a look at what's happening in the NBA schedule-wise, a full slate of games. They begin in the 5 o'clock hour. We get Boston at Indiana. New York will travel on the road to meet Washington. Those two games in the 5 o'clock hour. 6 o'clock, we get Cleveland at Chicago. Minnesota will travel to battle the Houston Rockets at 6. We get the Magic and the Grizzlies at 6 p.m. as well. The Mavericks take on the Spurs at 6. We get Phoenix at Portland at 8 p.m. The Clippers will travel to meet Golden State at 8:30. And then in the nightcap tonight, the Brooklyn Nets and the Los Angeles Lakers. LeBron James is questionable tonight with a sore groin. That's a quick look at what's happening at the national sports front. A lot to get to on the show today. We're going to give you the local sports recap in just a moment. We're going to catch up with Emory baseball manager Rob Smith. And then later on the show, we'll be joined by Danny Tarkanian, the son of Jerry Tarkanian. We'll talk about his new book and the somewhat controversial legacy of his father, who was constantly hounded by the NCAA. It's going to be a fun interview. That's coming up here on this Tuesday edition of Drive Time Sports.
There's no crying in baseball!
Prepare the water cooler, that we may gather around it later and discuss things. Play ball!
It's time for the Coach's Corner on Drive Time Sports.
Holy cow!
We're back on Drive Time Sports. Live from the Auto Forum Studios, let's talk high school baseball. We have a game going on right now. Carbon on the road taking on Provo. Emory is at home, their first home game of the season, going toe-to-toe with North Stampede. Today's the first of three home games for the Spartans. Tomorrow it'll be Payson, and then on Thursday they'll take on Uinta. We did catch up with manager Rob Smith earlier today. I wanted to get Coach Smith on the show so we could talk about everything that went down over the weekend, of course, with Emory playing three games in 3 days at home, and the start times being at around 3 o'clock, it was going to be difficult. So, a pre-recorded interview earlier today with Emory baseball manager Rob Smith. Coach, it's a pleasure as always to get you in. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Always look forward to it, Coach. I know it is a very busy week for you guys. You have three home games in 3 days, North Stampede, Payson, and Uinta, and we can talk about those games in just a bit, but more importantly, the season is now off and rolling. You guys played four games over the course of 3 days. I know it's not the outcome that you would have wanted, only winning one out of those four games, but still, what was the biggest takeaway from the four-game set of Mesquite over the weekend?
There was a lot of positives, a couple negatives. Positives going forward, hey, we got to turn the page, go forward, continue to work on the things that we've been working on. You know, the negatives, we got to throw strikes, got to put the ball in play when we have runners in scoring position.
Scoring runs, that was obviously a problem over the week. I believe you had three games where you only scored one run, right?
Right. And I think one of those runs came off a balk. We got to put the ball in play. We had 24 strikeouts, I believe. So we just got to put the ball in play, throw strikes, and I think we will continue to grow upon that. Like I said, my pitching staff is young. So just going forward, you know, put the ball in play, throw strikes, get ourselves a chance.
Yeah, you know, you and I have talked in years past about how you win games. I mean, is it going to be with offense or is it going to be with defense? And it seems typical that if you give up 3 to 4 runs, you should win that game, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Putting yourself in a spot to win that game.
Yeah, at least give yourself a chance.
So when you look at the way you guys performed offensively, you'd sent me the stats, a 184 batting average is what you guys had over the course of four games. It's almost impossible to win. It's almost shocking you guys won one game with a 184 batting average, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. A lot of strikeouts. We did hit the ball really hard. It was just right at people for the most part. A couple of them got through. But, you know, there was no clutch hit. No hit when we needed it big time. So,
as far as the individual play goes, I know that you guys had a couple of kids that really did shine, specifically on the offensive side of the plate. Talk to me about some of the individuals you were impressed with in that regard.
Oakley Alton swung it really well. Riker Jensen swung it well as well. Those are really the only two. I mean, like I said, we're young. A lot of first game jitters, first weekend jitters. A lot of these kids, it's their first varsity experience. So I think as they learn to slow the game down, you know, production will show.
Okay, so with that being said, and some of the youth that you guys you had to roll out there, in the same token, it's not as if you had a whole lot of time to prepare for that first weekend tournament. And I asked you what the competition level was, and you said some of the best pitching you've ever seen down there at that tournament.
Yeah, I agree. That's probably some of the best pitching we'll see throughout the whole year. There are teams we're going to play, Juab, Carbon, Richfield. They're going to have kids that are in that same talent level pitching-wise that we will see, but you know, that we've seen it, and now we can learn from it.
I know there hasn't been a lot of time in between what you guys did over the weekend and then today's game moving into the next two, but you did have practice yesterday. Was there any difference? Did you notice any difference from yesterday's practice, say, beforehand, going back, comparing it to the final practice before you went to Mesquite?
It was actually really good. The first two games, there wasn't a lot of energy. It was a good learning experience for the kids. The second two games, you know, the last game doesn't show how close of a game it was. We kind of fell apart there in the last inning. But for the most part, the energy picked up. Going into practice yesterday, the energy was there. I think they get it now, where they need to be energy-wise and going forward.
Well, let's talk about the one win of Mesquite. You guys did pick up a 6-1 victory over Virgin Valley. If I'm not mistaken, Luke Stilson pitched a complete game, if I remember right.
Yeah, he did. Threw a two-hitter. A one-hitter with two walks is all, and that really set the tone for us.
As far as other pitchers, I mean, you had made the point that you didn't have any pitchers that had ever thrown a varsity game going into the season. Who were some other pitchers that you saw some positives from?
Oakley Alton threw really well as well. He pounded the zone, gave us a chance. We had a couple errors and a couple walks there in the last inning. Riker threw well for the most part. Cove Johansson threw well. Trevin threw well. Just got to get those last three dialed in the strike zone, and I think we'll be fine.
Yeah, we always talk about the comfort level for players, right? They got to work through some things. They get used to playing baseball once again. In the same token, I know you've added a couple of new faces to your coaching staff as well. You guys got to get comfortable. From that perspective, how much do you feel the coaching staff improved over the weekend?
It was good. We learned a lot about the kids. We're able to, you know, on our downtime when we weren't playing, we were able to do some stuff together as a team, get to know each other. It was a good growing experience together.
Again, we're being joined right now by manager Rob Smith of the Emory High School baseball team. Coach, really, when you look at the schedule, three games this week and the next week, we're talking about region play already, and it's such a compact schedule. You and I talked about that last time we had you on. The fact is, North St. Pete, Pace, and Uena, and then after that, it is Region 12 play against Grand. So what are some of the big points of emphasis this week in these three games in 3 days?
We talked about it yesterday in practice, is keeping the energy up. Doing the simple things better, fielding the ground ball, throwing the ball through the base, not just to the base, you know, really working on the things we can control.
Just staying sharp.
Right.
Basically.
Yep.
When you look at the competition this week, St. Pete, Payson, and Uena, how does that stack up? What do you like about the competition?
Good competition. Payson, Uena, they're both good quality teams that kind of give us a gauge for where we're at going into region.
As far as the month of March is concerned, there's still a couple of non-region games left once we get past this week. You'll have to travel on the road to Providence Hall, and then, of course, you'll get the game at Smith's Ballpark. But then after that, once you get into the last week of March and then into April, I mean, it's region play every game. Every game does count, but I know there is some emphasis put on region. Have you paid attention to the way that the region has played out so far, some of the opponents you'll see?
I haven't too much. Mostly just been focusing on what we need to get done. Where we're at going forward.
And as far as the energy level, as you pointed out to this week, were you happy with that, Mesquite?
The first two games, no. We had a talk after the second game. And I think it kind of struck them that, yeah, we weren't ready to play. We weren't in it. We weren't talking. We weren't picking each other up. The next two games, the energy was there.
I know it's one of those trips where you hope to build team chemistry. You've talked to me about that in the past. You guys will do some things to kind of help get acclimated with one another. From a growing standpoint, is the team closer now coming back from that trip?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I definitely think so. For, I mean, Mesquite, you're away from your family. I try to make them stay in the hotel together, eat dinner together, do stuff around the resort that we stay out together, and I think it definitely helps them grow.
I know, again, it wasn't necessarily the way you would have liked to have seen that weekend go, but as long as you improve from it, that's all that really matters. Now three games this week, all three at home. That helps, too. I know you were away for the weekend, but nonetheless, you get the comfort of being at home.
Yeah, and it's always good to play home. We don't have to ride the bus. You know, we get to focus on the stuff that we need to do a little more because we can get out early and go do those things.
And it's the only three-game homestand of the season. Again, it takes place starting Tuesday. It will run until Thursday, bookending games with North St. Pete and Uinta in the middle of that. It's Pace and Coach Rob Smith, again, of the Emory High School baseball team. I appreciate you taking out the time to join us. I know you're a busy guy, so thank you very much. Best of luck this week, and we'll catch you at the ballpark.
All right, thanks for having me.
Again, that's Emory baseball manager Rob Smith. We did that interview earlier today. Emory right now going toe-to-toe with North St. Pete. They'll take on Payson tomorrow, and then they'll battle Uinta on Thursday. Three games in 3 days for the team this week. We are going to break for just a moment. When we return, we're going to move over to college basketball. It's March Madness. A lot going on around this time of the year. We're going to be joined by Danny Tarkanian. He's the son of legendary Hall of Fame coach Jerry Tarkanian. I think this is going to be a terrific conversation. We're going to talk about his latest book, Rebel with a Cause. Danny Tarkanian will share some of the stories of his dad, Jerry. We'll talk about the book. I'll have a few questions for him as well. That's coming up next when we return right here on Drive Time Sports.
You're listening to Drive Time Sports on KOAL AM 750, the play-by-play home of the USU Eastern Eagles.
We're back on Drive Time Sports. Live from the Auto Farm Studios, KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM. I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini, thrilled to bring in our next guest. He's the son of Hall of Fame legendary college basketball coach Jerry Tarkanian, Danny Tarkanian. Danny, who played for his dad once upon a time, obviously followed his career and has now released the new book, Rebel Without a Cause. This is the true story of Jerry Tarkanian. Danny, it is a pleasure to get you on the show today. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
I think we're going to have a fun conversation. You got to play for your dad, so you got to see him as a coach, got to know him as a father, got to follow his legendary career. You played for your dad, and I believe, if I read correctly, you guys won 24 consecutive games while you played. You saw some historical stuff as a player as well.
Yeah, I played for him from 1981 to 84. I came from Dixie Junior College my first year. I left the school as a leading person with assists and steals for game season and career. I didn't score very much, and that probably made it easier for me to play for my father because I hardly ever shot the ball. I passed it to all my other players, and they loved it that I didn't shoot, and they got to shoot.
Well, definitely. We'll get into that in just a moment, what it was like to play for your father. First off, I want to talk about the book. It's the true story of Jerry Tarkanian, Rebel with a Cause. I have it sitting in front of me right now. The first chapter I went to, and maybe I'm a little bit weird for doing this, but right off the bat, the chapter that stood out to me was the shortest stint for a coaching career in the NBA. I was really curious about Jerry Tarkanian's time with the San Antonio Spurs, and we can touch on that in just a moment. First things first, what was your inspiration for putting this book together?
Well, I grew up, as I mentioned in the book, I was a ball boy for my father. Then I was a former player for him, former coach, and actually his attorney through much of his NCAA battles. And I watched how his career was misconstrued, and the national media would write stories that weren't very accurate. And the NCAA had so much control over the media at that time that there never was a real true story about how my father was able to succeed going through the things that he did. And I wanted to write that. And then most recently, there's been so many stories about the NCAA and problems my father had complained about the NCAA 40, 50 years ago, and he was shrugged off as just a bitter person who got caught cheating. Now you're seeing that same things he said before are true, and other schools are experiencing the same thing, and I thought it was a good timing for the book.
Yeah, you know, I guess my perception of Jerry Tarkanian has always been this, a legendary coach that maybe he did play by the rules, maybe he didn't play by the rules. I mean, I guess it's all in perception, right? I know there's a lot of insight into that in this book, but that's always been my thought. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Well, you know, and that's one reason why I wanted to write it, to clarify, because I had all the documentation from the NCAA investigations, the court documents, their investigation notes. Listen, my father cheated like every other coach in the country is cheating. You have to cheat with what the NCAA rules are today and age of kids that are playing. Just for background for the listeners, the NCAA enforcement arm started in the 1950s, and the rules that were made applied to the kids that were playing back then, kids from affluent families with discretionary income. From the 60s on, the poor inner-city African-American kids that did not have any discretionary income. In fact, their families could barely afford the places they were living in at their home location, started dominating in the collegiate sports, and these same rules didn't apply. For example, you can't pay for a player to come to your school. So if you recruit a kid out of Fort Apache in the Bronx in New York, one of the worst high-rise areas in the entire country, very poor Richie Adams was a player, and he wants to come to school at UNLV, how does he get there? It's a violation to pay for him to get there. And every coach in the country who's recruiting these players are finding a way to get money to someone to pay for those kids to get there. Then once they come to school, my father's biggest complaint was the NCAA rules would make these kids live in extreme poverty, well below the standard living of the fellow classmates, and he thought that was wrong, particularly for considering the billions of dollars these athletes were bringing in. He was against, my father said, any large cheating, giving out large sums of money, buying them cars, doing anything of substantial value. But if you wanted to have a kid over for dinner, you should be able to do that as a coach, and my father did that. If a kid didn't have anything to wear and he was going someplace and he needed to get a new jacket or something, you bought him a jacket. And everything was all minor stuff, and you know, one of the big violations they found against UNLV was they were providing free transportation to student athletes. Well, the free transportation was picking the kid up from his apartment and driving him to school when he wasn't in class. You know, they just make the violations look bad, and they're not really bad. So every coach who's recruiting and those type of athletes are all making, they're all cheating the same way, and they all know it. It's the big cheaters, the ones that you're seeing now with the shoe companies paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to come to your school that should be hammered by the NCAA. And they never even made an allegation my dad gave anything of substantial value to a recruit or any of his boosters or coaches.
Again, our guest right now is Danny Tarkanian, the son of legendary coach Jerry Tarkanian. And Danny, when you talk about the success that your dad had, putting the NCAA allegations and the troubles with the NCAA aside, I've always felt that one of the biggest sticking points for your father in winning at the college level was the fact that he had that natural knack to find talent. And a lot of the times, he would even dig into junior college transfers, which is so interesting to me, especially here in this area where we have junior college basketball that's played at an extremely high level. You grab a kid like Larry Johnson, and you can get him to buy in playing together, playing fast, playing, I guess, in a different realm with kids who have already committed to a four-year school, bypassing that junior college level. That's what was fascinating to me about your father.
Yeah, and I went through that a lot in the book. Most of the kids that go to junior college are kids that either were poor students or got in trouble off the court. My father, when he was growing up, he was Armenian heritage that was growing up in the Central Valley, California, so they were discriminated against. They had no money. He was a horrible student. It took him 6 years to graduate from college, and he said if he hadn't met my mother, it'd been 10 years. He was got in trouble off the court doing stupid things. So he understood these players that he was recruiting. A lot of coaches wouldn't touch these players. In fact, in the book, I have a quote from Matt Doherty, who used to coach with Roy Williams, and he said, Danny, don't take this the wrong way, but we wouldn't recruit the players your father does. We just couldn't coach them because these guys all had problems. Well, my dad understood those problems because the way he grew up, he was able to motivate these players through sarcasm and wit as opposed to being a tyrant and a bully, and he got them to play together cohesively as a team. These players had the same type of talent as those great players that were going to UCLA and Duke, except they weren't as good as students, and they had personal problems off the court. And my father felt that he could win with them, and he did.
Your dad goes to UNLV in 1973, and the school hadn't been around, at least for a Division I program, for that very long. And I think in today's day and age, where we're talking about professional sports in Las Vegas, right, we have the Golden Knights. We'll soon have the Las Vegas Raiders. I don't think it's that far off from having an NBA team in Vegas. All this being said, people need to remember that the first big sports show in Las Vegas, that was UNLV. Going back to 1983, this was because of Tarcadian success. You got to see this up close and personal. And it wasn't just the game, and it wasn't just the athletes that he was bringing in. It was the pregame fireworks. There were theatrics. Yeah. It was the first big show in Vegas for a sporting event. That revolves around UNLV and Jerry Tarcadian.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right, and I touched upon that in the book. Las Vegas is the entertainment capital of the world, and the biggest entertainment show in Las Vegas during the first 19 years there was the Runnin' Rebels. They played not only one big, but they played the most exciting brand of basketball you can play. In 1975-76, they started the run-and-gun style of play with a pressure defense. They averaged 108 points a game and 110 points a game those 2 years. That was without the shot clock or the three-point line. So you're playing this exciting brand of basketball. You're winning big. There is fourth year at UNLV. They went to the Final Four and lost to a North Carolina team by 1 point who had four Olympians on it and coached by the Olympic coach. So they were winning. They had the exciting brand of basketball. But you said, the great pregame show. I mean, it was amazing. We had fireworks. We had the strobe lights. We had the laser sharks, and it was something else. And we had Gucci Row, which is like what the Lakers have now, where all their movie stars would come and sit in the front row, or the real wealthy people. We had Gucci Row before that, where you had Frank Sinatra, Diana Ross, Dean Martin, they'd come to the games. Wayne Newton would sing the national anthem. Some of them would even come to practice. You couldn't get a ticket to the game. It was impossible. They used to have people sitting in the aisles where there was a fire risk, and they would just let it go because you couldn't get them to move. It was a wonderful experience, something that you appreciate so much more after it's done.
Danny, and again, I haven't read the entire book, and so this question I'm going to ask you, if it is discussed at all in the book, I apologize. I heard a rumor once upon a time that Gucci Row, and again, as you were just mentioning, where you had the rich and famous sitting courtside, that had a lot to do with your dad. Is it true that your dad had negotiated a certain ticket allotment into his contract with UNLV?
He did, but not for any Gucci Row seats. They gave him the seats up higher. Gucci Row was the front row where the scholarship people who had all the money and or the celebrities that had to pull the juice, they sat. But my father did. He got so many seats, I forget, when under his contract. I think it was 10% at the convention center, which was, at that time, 6,000 some. So he got like 64 seats to each game. Then when they went to the Thomas and Mack Center, it was 18,000. So he was provided several hundred tickets. And he used those tickets to give them out to boosters around town, casino hosts. And in exchange, he went anywhere he wanted in Las Vegas, ate for free. He would go to shows for free. It was something that it's unheard of in today's day and age of corporate ownership of these casinos. But back then, it was the most amazing time to grow up in.
Well, Danny, there's plenty more I would love to talk with you about. We do got a break for just a moment. Do you have time to hang around for one more segment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. More coming up with Danny Tarcadian, the son of Jerry Tarcadian. We'll talk about his new book and more about his father's legendary career right here on Drive Time Sports. We're back on Drive Time Sports, continuing our conversation right now with Danny Tarcadian, the son of legendary college basketball coach Jerry Tarcadian, and also the author of the new book, Rebel with a Cause. It's the true story of Jerry Tarcadian. Just looking at what your father has accomplished, I mean, it's absolutely incredible when you take a look at the amount of wins that he put together in a decade span. I mean, it even eclipses some of the greatest college basketball coaches to ever live. For instance, a 10-year period from 83 to 92 at UNLV, 307 wins. That's more than what Bob Knight ever did in Indiana. It's more what I like to call John Wooden, the greatest coach, I believe, of all time. It's more than he accumulated with UCLA, more than Adolph Rupp, more than Fog Allen with the Kansas Jayhawks. And I know that some people could say, well, they play more games today, but nobody else has come close to that in a 10-year span. And so, Danny, as you and I were having a conversation off the cuff, you had mentioned that you wanted to talk about the way your father motivated players, which was a little bit unorthodox compared to some of the coaches that I just named.
Yeah, and you know, he only lost, I believe, 30 games during that 10-year period. So he lost games a year and was winning 30, which is, it hasn't been matched before. And they were on a run my dad was first out of UNLV to have even better teams. He had Ed O'Bannon, Charles O'Bannon, and Sean Tarver trying to come to UNLV. They took UCLA to the final, to the national championship in 85, and he had Jason Kidd committed as a sophomore. But that being said, what I wanted to get across in the book, one of the most important things to me was Well, it's to show the kind of person my father had in his relationship with the players and why that led to such success. In the 60s and early 70s, the coaches back then were always considered the boss, the tyrants. You know, they would yell and motivate their players through intimidation. Bobby Knight's a great example. My father was a complete opposite. He felt that if you got really close with these players, particularly ones that had problems off the court or in the classroom, and you created a close bond with them, you can get them to play harder than any other team in the country. And he would motivate us through sarcasm and wit. He would say something that, and I'll give you an example. When I was playing in 1983, we didn't play hard in practice one day, so he called the team together and he said, "You guys are all a bunch of bandits. Next time you pick up your scholarship check, wear a mask and gun because you're robbing the university." And, you know, we're sitting there wanting to laugh because it's pretty darn funny, but scared to death by the way he said it. But what we did was we went out and we played harder than you could possibly imagine after that. And there's numerous examples of my father being like that. And also being very honest with players. When normally you wouldn't want to be honest, the politically correct people wouldn't accept these things. And I'll give another example. When I played, we were 24-0 and number one in the country, and some of our players were complaining, and my father favored our two best players, Sidney Green and Larry Anderson. So my dad called the team together, and he said, "I understand some of you think I'm favoring Sid and Larry. I just want you to know that I am. Sid and Larry are carrying us. Without them, we wouldn't be 24-0. If we're on a desert island with one cantina of water, I'm going to make sure Sid and Larry have everything what they want to drink. If there's anything left over, I might share with the rest of you." That's what all of us were thinking at that time. But you know what? We knew that he was honest, that he was telling us the truth, and deep down we also knew Larry and Sid were carrying us, and we ended up having a great team that year.
You were obviously around in 1990, around your dad, when UNLV wins the national championship. And that story, that's the one sad part. And I think this is just history, right? This is the way it works in sports. It's a "what have you done for me lately" type deal. While this team may have won a national championship in 1990, 1991 is probably, they're in the conversation to be the greatest college basketball team ever. And they didn't win a national championship. And I think it's a true testament to just how difficult it is to win a title when it's a one-game-and-done type scenario. Because your father had coached several teams that were more than capable of winning a national championship, but maybe none more so than that 1991 team.
Oh, absolutely. My dad will say unequivocally the 91 team was his best team they ever coached. They had a national schedule, a non-conference schedule of top 10 teams all across the board, including the number two team, Arkansas, at Arkansas. And they only had one game within 10 points in the entire season until they lost to Duke by two. And, you're right. It's tough to repeat. And I know that there was a lot of pressure on those players. And then people forget how good Duke was. Duke had some great, great players on that team. Leitner and Hurley, two of the best college players ever. And Grant Hill, one of the great NBA players. It's not really a shocker in retrospect, but it was back then.
Looking at the accomplishments that your father put together, unfortunately, it did come to an end based off of really three players being photographed in a hot tub with a convicted sports event fixer, and it was never proven that those individuals took part in any sort of fixing, but at that particular time it seemed like the damage was done. When you go back and you look at what your father still had left to accomplish at UNLV, he may be considered the greatest college basketball coach that ever lived if he was able to coach another, 10 years at the school.
Well, they had forced him out of UNLV because of those hot tub pictures when he was 60 years old. He had another 15 or 20 years to coach. And as I mentioned previously, he was bringing in better players at the end than they ever had at the beginning. And they would have won another several national championships. But when you talk about the hot tub picture, it's really that was the final straw of so much more. But I want to clarify something with the hot tub pictures. The reason why it had such a major impact was when we lost to Duke by two, there was a rumor spread by the athletic director that one of our players, Stacey Ogden, was in the locker room crying after the game because he threw the game. It was a bunch of BS. That didn't happen, but they were trying to discredit my father so they can find a way to force him out. Those three players in the hot tub, first of all, the convicted felon, point shaver you're talking about, he had changed his name so people didn't know his background, and he was a former AAU coach in New York City, and he coached a bunch of players from back there, including Moses Scurry, who was one of the players in that hot tub. But when you talk about whether they point shaved, Moses Scurry and David Butler had won the national championship and graduated before that pitcher came out, and they weren't even on the team that lost to Duke the next year. The only player in the hot tub on the team that lost to Duke was Anderson Hunton. He was our best player. He had 30 or 32 points in the game. He obviously didn't throw the game. So there's nothing to it, but there was just accumulation of stuff. And I went through this in the book. I'll try to be real quick because I know this is taking a lot of time. Is when my father first came to UNLV, he was very controversial fighting the NCAA, bringing in those type of players that I mentioned. But UNLV, Las Vegas, had a horrible reputation too, so it was like a perfect match, Sin City with this controversial coach, Draker, and all these at-risk kids. Well, Las Vegas wanted to change his image in the late 80s as Steve Wynn was building the family casinos, and they brought in a new president who said that UNLV was going to be the Harvard of the West. When all that happened, my dad's still fighting the NCAA, and he's still bringing in the same kids, and they felt that my father's image was bringing down the university. There's a lot of quotes in the book from people who mentioned the same thing. So they forced my father out basically because they wanted to change the image of the university and felt my father's image was bringing him down. It really wasn't the hot tub picture. It was just the avenue that allowed them to get there.
Again, I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, I was fascinated by the idea of reading about Jerry Tarkanian's time with the San Antonio Spurs, because a lot of people don't remember that. It's such a small footnote when you look over the history of his career, but you did talk about that. I know it's a very short chapter because, well, it was a very short tenure with the San Antonio Spurs. What do you remember most about that?
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot to write about. Well, I just, the decisions that change your life and what happens is really big. My father was offered the job when he left UNLV by the Philadelphia 76ers. The owner loved my dad, and my dad loved Charles Barkley. And Charles wasn't a big name at that time. He had become the superstar he ultimately would. But the Sixers weren't very good, and my dad didn't feel he would have that much time left in his coaching career to turn them into a winner. When Larry Brown left San Antonio, San Antonio had one of the best teams in the NBA, so my dad jumped at it when he was offered that job. The only problem is three of his five starters weren't available when the season started. Two of them got hurt and were out the entire year, and the third one was the worst one. He's a great point guard named Rod Strickland that the Spurs didn't re-sign, let him go to the Portland Trailblazers. So my dad complained about the players that were on the team. They were losing. He lost 11 games out of 20, and that's more losses than he had in the last 3 years at UNLV. So he complained in the papers about his roster. So the owner and the general manager called him in and said, if you don't think you can win with this roster, you should leave. And my dad said, well, I think we can't win with this roster. So he left. The NBA is different. The owner and the general manager tells the coach what players he's going to coach. And in college, the coach gets to determine which players he's coaching. And that just didn't work for my father.
In the late 70s, there's a rumor that your dad was at least a front runner for the Los Angeles Laker coaching job. And again, revisionist history, just going back and looking at that Lakers 80s dynasty for your dad to coach a guy like Magic Johnson, who loved to play at the fast pace, right? I mean, that was showtime, right? How close was your dad to taking that job with the Los Angeles Lakers in the late 70s? And how special could that run have been with him at the helm?
Yeah, probably 30 minutes was the difference between him being a Laker coach and not. And my father said when the Lakers had the first draft and Magic put his name in it that the Lakers were going to win a bunch of championships because of how great Magic was. He knew how good they were going to be. First of all, the Lakers offered him a job, and actually there was a contract that was provided to my dad's agent, who was my dad's boyhood friend, close with them. His name was Vic Weiss, and I go through this in the book. Vic Weiss met with the owner of the Lakers, Jerry Buss, and I'm sorry. He met with Jerry Buss, and Jerry gave him the signed contract with his signature on it. And he was to meet my mother and father for dinner right after he left the Buss's meeting. And he was never seen again. Somehow somebody got a hold of him, killed him, and stuck him in a trunk. And when my dad learned of it, he was very disheartened, and he still wasn't sure he wanted to go coach the NBA because he really loved the college game, and he decided not to go do it. I know he had a lot of regrets the rest of his life because we'd watch those NBA finals, and he'd say, isn't this big time? Look how much fun this would have been.
The next guy in line there in the 80s was going to have a lot of success with that Laker team. It really didn't matter who it was, right? And so we talk about what your dad built at UNLV. He'd have been front and center in L.A.
Yeah, he would have, and I think he would have won big there, too, and he certainly would have had an incredible experience. But, you know, again, he was made for college coaching because he was able to work with and develop and help kids that needed them the most. In the NBA, they're all millionaires. They don't need somebody to help guide them through their personal and social problems they were having. So in an overall standpoint, you know, what plates did my dad have a bigger impact? It certainly was in the college game.
Oh, no question. There's no question about it. And still today, if you walk the campus of UNLV or if you visit the Thomas and Mack Center, your dad has definitely been memorialized there. He's almost immortal. When you talk about UNLV basketball, even with the state it's in now, there are still people that will travel around to either take a picture with the statue out front or at least get a glimpse of Jerry Tarkanian, the court itself, which, of course, also pays homage to your father.
Yeah, you know, I got a son named Jerry. He's 10 years old, and about 2 years ago, we're driving around town, and there was this Jerry Tarkanian Way, the street they named after him, and he'd already seen the statue in the court. And he says to me, "Dad, thank you so much for calling for naming me Jerry." I said, "Why is that?" And he goes, "Because they named so many things after me." I said, "That in itself makes it worthwhile."
Danny, before I let you go, I want to get your take on the book once again, Rebel with a Cause, which is available right now for anyone who was interested in reading more about the legendary career of Jerry Tarkanian. Back to your inspiration for the book and what your ultimate goal was in releasing it.
Well, I wanted people to understand the kind of person my father was and the true success that he had. He was a person with no ego at all. He would always try to learn something from other coaches that were not nearly as acclaimed as him. He had just a great relationship with people, not only the players, as I mentioned, but the fans, big boosters. He got along with everybody, knew how to deal with people. And then I wanted to, you know, explain the struggles that he had with the NCAA and, you know, why what his position was really a very needed position, because he was a voice for the kids that didn't have a voice and were being taken advantage of by the NCAA structure and the rules that they implemented. So I'm hoping that I got that across in the book and that the readers will have a better understanding of the kind of person my father was.
It's available right now, The True Story of Jerry Tarkanian, A Rebel with a Cause. Again, Danny Tarkanian, our guest right now. Danny, it was a pleasure to chat with you over the last 30 minutes to talk about your father's legendary career. I can't wait to finish reading the book. I really appreciate the time. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Excellent conversation with Danny Tarkanian, again, the son of legendary coach Jerry Tarkanian and author of the new book, Rebel with a Cause. That's going to do it for us today. We will be back again on Thursday. Tomorrow, we'll be back in the broadcast booth for Emory High School Baseball as the Spartans will go toe-to-toe with Payson. Live coverage of that game will begin at about 2:45 tomorrow right here on KOAL. Be safe. I am out.